The following audio was recorded at the Pacific School Leadership Institute, which was held October 24 and 25, 2019, in Spokane, Washington.
The book I was assigned to review is The History of Christian Education, A Mennonite Perspective. The author is Lester E. Showalter. It was published by Rod and Staff Publishers in 1997 as a part of their History Library series. It is a fairly rapid read with under 100 pages. One of author Showalter's associates at Paradise Mennonite School at Hagerstown, Maryland, was the late Dwayne Tucker, a teaching veteran. He said at a teacher's meeting many years ago, "If you don't know where you came from, quote, if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going," unquote. His point, knowing your history is critical to the direction of your life that your life will take. Whether you follow the worthy steps of the faithful before you or set a course to overcome the deficiencies of your forefathers. Showalter's book begins with schooling in the Reformation period. Then came the Anabaptists, who radically turned from the world system, using the Bible as their textbook. In the midst of persecution, the Anabaptists taught the Bible to their followers. The Martyr's Mirror credit is given in the Martyr's Mirror credit is given to the grace which God grants our simple converts when we, with all diligence, teach them to read. Several martyrs left written instructions that their children's education was not to be neglected. The Anabaptists were diligent in education with a godly purpose. The first German Mennonites landed in Philadelphia in 1683, finding freedom from persecution. That same year, 1683, the Pennsylvania colony passed a law requiring that all children were to be instructed in reading and writing so that they may be able to read the scriptures and be able to write by the time they attain to 12 years of age. Even earlier than the Pennsylvania law, a similar law was passed in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Both these laws were based on one thing, the objective to read the Bible. In America, the Mennonites bought land on Skippack Creek in eastern Pennsylvania prior to 1720, specifying that there was to be established a schoolhouse to have their children taught and instructed. They employed a German teacher named Christopher Dock, who taught Mennonite children and became a superior schoolmaster. Showalter quotes from Dock's writings regarding his teaching methods, and they make fascinating reading. Following the Revolutionary War, there was a shift in American education. Now the government wanted to promote and require education. The purpose, a radical one, was for the promotion of democracy, not for the reading of the Bible. The Mennonites were opposed to the new shift, but free public education became the norm. In the early 1800s, public schools seemed safe enough, but they began to change. Mennonite children were exposed to to textbooks that glorified wars and war heroes, and associations with worldly children led some young people astray. With the removal of the Bible and religion from the public schools, there was left a vacuum of values. Consequently, a breakdown in morals resulted. I learned in reading of Showalter's book that the first Mennonite Christian day school, separate from Christopher Dock's school, was established in Greenwood, Delaware in 1928. The state of Delaware had passed a law requiring all students to salute the flag, and the conservative Mennonites there responded by creating a school in their church building. Christian day schools in other communities soon followed. In Maryland and Pennsylvania, and by 1940, there were seven such schools. During the 1940s, 39 more schools were started. In the 50s, there was a decline in Christian day schools because of apostasy. The beginning of the fellowship movement in the 1960s and the forming of the Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Church in 1968 presented a whole new package of church organization, of mission work, of publication, of colonization, and also of education. Showalter says, he also concludes that today, the Christian school is considered a necessary and normal part of Christian life in conservative communities. Quote, "We no longer look at it as an option. It has become conviction," unquote. That may be Showalter's most profound statement in his writing. The book's final chapter consists of what Showalter sees as the future of Christian education from his perspective in 1997. He also suggests that he envisions as threats to our schools a list worth reading. We know that we cannot change history, but decisions we make today concerning our schools will make history of tomorrow. I highly recommend this book, and it's on for sale on Wes's table. God bless you.
I've been asked to introduce the book Ideas and Checklists for School Board Members, which incidentally was written by my preacher. And if you know him, he's a man who likes checklists, likes short, sharp one-liners. And also, if you're a practical person, you know that checklists are very important. When we moved to Washington in 2006, Memorial Day weekend, we had a very small hot dog roast at our place because we were cleaning it up and had some of the family there cleaning up the property. It became a tradition, and we've had a Memorial Day pig roast at our place every year since, and now we have up to like 60 people come there for all weekend. And I soon discovered there was only one way that thing worked, and that was my wife's checklist. And, of course, the most important thing on her checklist was the one that she handed to me. And so when I sit down at a school board meeting, I like a checklist. And I also like the part that's for me because I'm the secretary, and so I notice some interesting things. Number one, he says that the secretary of the school board should be a quiet member. He wrote this book before I was on the board with him. I will just give you a short list of the table of contents. He says the general responsibilities of the school board, the school administrator's line of authority, and then the roles of each of those. And one of the things that's impressed me with this meeting is the emphasis on vision. And our board has several different times tried to have a discussion about vision. But it usually begins at 8:30, and we never like to be there any longer than 9 o'clock. But I think one of the main reasons that we don't discuss vision more is we spend so much time with the nuts and bolts and rehashing things that doesn't need to be rehashed. And if we had more checklists that we moved down over, our meetings would get over a lot faster, and we could get to the things that really, really matter. And that's why I recommend this book. I will try to give you just a few one-liners from it. He says, in the beginning, that since we believe that educating children is a primarily religious function authorized by God himself, we choose to send our children to church-operated schools. Have you really thought about that? There's the one about the quiet board member with sharp ears and an impartial mind usually makes the best secretary. Or where do we draw the line between the board's responsibilities and the teacher's? Personalities cause this to vary, but there needs to be a rule of thumb that the board deals with general policies and they give the teacher room to make everyday decisions. About hiring new teachers, it's a bit like finding a spouse because your children will have to live with whoever you pick. What about firing a teacher? He even discusses that. Nothing hurts a teacher more than suspecting that the board is hiding the real reason that they don't like him. I think boards need to think about some of those things. And I want to just wrap up with some of his last sentences. An effective chairman will solicit discussion, will summarize discussion, will bring issues to a conclusion and to a vote when he senses the group is ready to act. Just a few thoughts for a chairman to have down pat will make a meeting move. And then we mentioned handbooks. He even has in here a standard sample constitution and bylaws. And by the way, the last sentence says these standards may be revised to meet current needs. I don't know if it's every year or 5 years or 30.
I was assigned to give a report on the book, The Collapse of Parenting by Dr. Leonard Sachs. I don't usually read New York Times bestsellers. But this is one that I would recommend that you read. I found it very interesting. It's written from a secular viewpoint by a doctor. It's a very valuable resource in understanding current issues with our children. Now, we may focus more on the spiritual side of some of these issues, but it's good to look at the physical factors, what is driving these things. Dr. Sachs is a medical doctor and a psychologist. He writes from 30 years of experience in medical practice and his observations from that. His primary source material is 90,000 plus office visits that he has conducted since 1989. He has seen from the doctor's perspective the profound changes in American life and witnessed the collapse of parenting. Also, since 2001, he has visited more than 380 venues, meeting face-to-face with students, teachers, and/or parents. In laying a foundation, he gives some reasons for this. First of all, he says that a human has a much longer period of immaturity than most animals, and the purpose of this childhood and adolescence period is for enculturation. It takes years to master the details of language, of culture, of behavior. Quote, no child is born knowing the rules. Every child must be taught. Unquote. Throughout the 20th century, especially since 1945, Western civilization has become increasingly uncomfortable with power differentials in human relations. This has had the effect of decreasing the authority and importance of the parent in the child's life. Quote, in American culture today, peers matter more than parents. And also, quote, children no longer learn culture from grown-ups. They have their own culture, a culture of disrespect. In North America, new has become synonymous with improved. This easily translates into the celebration of young over old. And complicating this, since about 1985, the public schools no longer teach the social graces, socialization. They no longer promote that. What are the results? He lists four results. One is that children are becoming increasingly obese. Why? There's three factors: what they eat, what they do, and how much they sleep. Now, a couple of quotes. When parents begin to cede control to children, food choices are often the first things to slide. Found that very interesting. Another quote, the average 9-year-old American child spends 50 hours per week in front of a screen. Hope that that's not our children. All right. Another factor, or another result, is too much medication, and I'll let you read the book on that. It's easier for school administrators, doctors, and parents to try medication than to address parenting deficiencies. American students are falling behind. Children are becoming fragile. They require unconditional love. They do not get that from their peers. They do not get that from a report card. They need a strong primary attachment to their parents. All right, what is the solution? Well, he goes into a lot of things, but I'll just read a few things here that are conclusions that he came to. Your job is to be the authoritative parent, not the cool peer. There is no greater responsibility between human beings than that of a parent to a child. There's no greater responsibility. Assert the primacy of the parent-child relationship. I hope that these few minutes have piqued your interest in this book. I believe it's a very valuable resource, and I believe that it's something that we as parents, school board members, teachers need to read. Thank you.
Really great to be here today. Really awesome day. A lot of truth spoken already. Jonathan asked me to read the book, The Thread That Runs So True, written by Jesse Stewart. And I have to admit, I'm not a particularly avid reader, so I probably would not have read this had he not asked me to. But I'm really glad I did. It was very enjoyable and very motivating. These are basically the memoirs of Jesse Stewart. He was a school teacher in a very remote and rural part of eastern Kentucky in the 1920s and 30s. He taught his first year of school when he was barely 17. I don't think he had quite turned 17 on the first day of school, in a community called Lonesome Valley, which was near where he was raised. And his motive for wanting to teach there at that particular school was because his sister had been beat up there by a unruly teenager in first grade. and so he starts there, and the book follows his various teaching ventures from Lonesome Valley on to other schools and other positions of service in the education system. There are brief sections where Stewart will elaborate on a particular aspect of teaching, or he'll call attention to strengths and weaknesses of the education system. But mostly the chapters read as though he was just casually telling stories by a campfire, recalling fond memories of his students and their achievements. One interesting story took place during his term at the county high school. They had this really bad problem with just tardiness and absences due to late night drinking and gambling going on among the student body. And one day he caught some of the young men gambling on school grounds. And so, of course, when the parents heard about this, there was a great uproar. But rather than defend himself, Jesse just waited for the next PTA meeting. And he just waited for a chance where he could talk to everybody at once about the larger problem, which was the nightlife going on in the evenings, and thereby putting the responsibility on their shoulders as parents. And I'd like to read a paragraph from that, if I may, as he was closing his address. He just says, "One more thing, and this is all I have to say," I concluded. "Landsberg High School is not a separate unit from you. We are part of you. Every man, woman, and child in this community is a part of Landsberg High School. Your ways of life in your homes and in the town reflect here in the school. You can help us or you can hurt us. Our success here depends largely on you. I used to think when I first started teaching school that it was all up to the teachers and the pupils. I have changed my mind. The little island of humanity that is each one of you must unite with other islands and become a mainland if we are to have a successful school." And even though he wrote those words nearly 100 years ago, there's still a lot of very sound truth in that, which I found the case throughout the whole book. He has a very unique perspective on education because he served a lot of different positions. He was a teacher and a principal and a superintendent for a time. And so he knows a lot about education. Just his passion for giving people good education really shines through. So as a teacher myself, I was just super inspired and kind of fired up to just be all that I can be as a teacher. And I think anybody who wants to read this book, I think you'll be very blessed, definitely getting a greater appreciation for the value and the privilege it is to have a good education. And just be encouraged to find ways, in whatever role you are in today, find ways to make that a reality for our young people today. Thank you.